The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is Once More with Feeling by Austin DeMarco. You are dead. Not literally dead, no, but you might as well be. You don't smile. You don't frown. You don't laugh or sob. But the thing is, nobody does anymore. 3 years ago, the world died. There was no warning. No one submitted a memo. One morning, everyone woke up and nobody was scared. Nobody was angry or hurt or happy or sad. Nobody felt anything but cold logic. And the world is better off. The population has stopped growing out of control. Hunger and crime have been all but eliminated. People are safe. Maybe not happy, but safe. Trouble is, you miss your emotions, as much as you can miss anything these days. You watch old movies late into the night and try to feel how you felt when you watched them for the first time. You can't. You know you felt something, but the memory is intellectual, like trying to describe color to a blind man. It doesn't help you feel. So today, you're making an experiment. Seems logical, right? Identify the problem, determine a solution, test. From your movies, it appears that all the good emotions, humor, happiness, pleasure, joy, all arise from interactions with others. So it is possible that if you interact with another human being in a manner other than the logical fulfillment of your everyday tasks, this will be enough to elicit an emotion. You stand on the street outside your apartment and look for likely candidates, but everyone appears the same. Their faces set in the same expression of concentration, eyes forward and unwavering. Eventually, you choose someone at random, a boy you don't remember meeting before. The boy wears a red baseball cap and a shirt that is only half tucked into his shorts. His lips are set in a line. He moves like he has somewhere to go, but does not rush. There is no urgency in him. You step up to the boy. Imitate the smile you have seen in your old movies, though you do not feel the emotion this expression is supposed to convey. You say, "What kind of dinosaur has the biggest vocabulary?" Pause. "A thesaurus!" Your delivery of the joke is flawless, but you feel nothing. You wait for a reaction from the boy, but there is nothing. He steps past you and continues on his way. Your experiment is a failure, but you remember negative emotions were always stronger than positive ones, so perhaps you are going about this the wrong way. You quickly revise your experiment. Then turn after the boy, walking just fast enough to catch him. You grab his shoulders, pause for a second, and push. The boy, not expecting your assault, falls. He doesn't move his arms to catch himself, and his head strikes a fire hydrant. His body spins, and you can see a large gash in his forehead, already streaming blood. You feel something that is hard to define. You have been without emotions for so long that it is hard to identify them now that you have finally managed to elicit one. Anger? The word doesn't seem to fit, though it doesn't matter because the feeling is fleeting. Another lingers longer. Remorse, you think. But then this, too, fades. Standing over the boy, you stare down at his body. You think he is still breathing. The memory of your recent emotions lingers in your head like the echoing pain of a bruised funny bone. But you do not want it. You want to remember feeling good, not bad. How do you make yourself feel something good? Carefully supporting his neck, like you have seen in your old movies, you lift the boy off the ground. He is heavy, but not so heavy that you cannot carry him for several blocks. There is a hospital not far from where you stand, and you bring him there, taking care to avoid bumping into anyone else. You reach the hospital and alert a nurse walking through the lobby. He had an accident. She looks at the boy's head briefly. You realize that you left his baseball cap in the street. Then signals to her co-workers, and they take him from you. The nurse says nothing other than a brief and emotionless thank you. But it is enough. You feel swellings of pride, happiness, satisfaction in a job well done. The feelings are gone just as quick, but they are enough. You smile, a smile that you imagine is more genuine than it really is. That was a good feeling, one you would not be opposed to feeling again.
No Worries by Jason A. Bartels. I stand in line to buy a beverage, tuning out the halitosis and manufactured perfumes that bristle against my wattle. Its purpose is not to keep us cool. We don't perspire like the humans, always leaking fluids from every crevice and fold. They must find it uncomfortable to live on this planet, adapted to colder climates as they are. Our wattles are finely tuned to detect minor changes in the wind, whether it be the oncoming storm or the return of springtime. "Hey," says a human behind me. I know what they will ask. "Can I touch that dangly thing on your neck? What do you call it?" "No thanks," I say, and turn around to order. "That was rude," the human whispers to another. "The older ones struggle to adapt," they reply. "Old dogs, you know." "The children are progressing quite nicely," chimes in a third. "Ginger tea for..." The barista hesitates to pronounce my name. I smile with kindness as I collect my beverage. As I turn to leave, I bump into the noisy human. "My bad," I say, following their customs. "No worries," they claim as they clump the receptors of my wattle with oil from their German-crusted fingertips. A pang of bile erupts in the back of my throat. "It's not as flabby as you'd expect," they explain to onlookers. "You ever consider getting it removed?" My tea splatters on the floor as I try to free myself from their grip. Later, I wish I had struck back, but in the moment, I have the good sense to walk away. The humans have demonstrated what will happen if we stray from our new place in this world. I rush out the door, and with any luck, I will have time to unclog my pores before the workday begins. Each week, I inspect the cellar entrance beside my cabin. No rust or warping. The weatherproofing remains intact. The locks slide open, and the scent of damp clay and roots relax my wattle. The cellar is pitch black after I seal the hatch. I feel my way in the dark, an exercise I have maintained since childhood, long before humans arrived. Soon-to-expire canned goods rest on a shelf near the ladder. I place them in my basket, shift the remaining jars leftward, and stock this season's batch. I tuck freshly laundered towels into drawers and change the bed sheets. I return to the surface, and as I lock up, I hear a rambunctious group of humans in an approaching vehicle. The passengers tuck their hands into noisome armpits and wave their elbows while clucking in my direction. I grind my teeth in silence. Whenever this happens in the presence of friendlier humans, they explain it as an innocuous display of mirth and gaiety. "You're just being sensitive," they say. "I'll work on that." "It's all good," they reassure me. I prefer to enter the conference room last. My job is to record my employer's endless debates about which of our ancestral thoroughfares to pave and rename in their own image. "This one's a keeper. It learned to cover its genitals," says my boss, pointing at the fabric that drapes below my chin. "Forgive me, but these are not my genitals," I blurt out before realizing what I have done. Their absurd statement catches me off guard. I do not suffer this gauzy covering out of modesty or decorum, but to keep my passages clear. The humans have developed interstellar flight, yet the minor differences in our physiology leave them utterly flummoxed. And when they struggle to understand, they can become incensed, which causes them to emanate hormones that linger on my sensors for days. I have to weigh the risk of missing vital ambient signs against the possible long-term damage from an unexpected outburst or a public groper. "No need to get embarrassed," they say. "I'm complimenting you." I need this job, so I regain my composure. "My apologies," I say, and take my seat along the wall. "Whatever it is, we're glad you act normal about it," says my boss. The other humans in the room either nod along or stare at the table. A fellow secretary invites me to lunch. We step outside and remove our coverings. Immediately, our wattles swell as trace amounts of carbon monoxide waft through the air. We scuttle our plans and hurry home. I was quite young for the last of these storms. My elders rushed us down the ladder and sealed us in the lightless shelter. After endless days of migraines and itchy lungs, a neighbor knocked with the all-clear signal. Distracted by the memories, I bump into a human on the sidewalk. "Excuse me," I say to preempt their rage. "No worries," they flash a closed-lipped smile. The humans bustle about the surface of our planet with cool indifference. But today, they should be more alert. Instead, they saunter away with not a care in any of the worlds under their control. I prepare to explain the dire circumstances, to implore them to seek cover, but they will dismiss me as an overly sensitive native. The bile rising in my wattle snaps me back to the danger. By nightfall, anyone left on the surface will perish in the noxious clouds. All of us are headed underground until the air becomes breathable again. It could be a day or a week, but we prepare for twice as long. I open the hatch and climb down. I wonder what it will take to break the humans of their false sense of security, of their belief that nature can be bent to their every whim. I suppose we are about to find out.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I'll be reading Taking Care by Jonathan Holmes. I don't understand, All I did was fix her. All my life, since before I can remember, you've been telling me to take better care of Emmy, and I have. I do. Better than anyone. I always make sure she's got food, and I take her everywhere I go, and I make sure she's okay. She almost never gets hurt when I'm watching her, and, okay, there was that one time, but that wasn't my fault. She just stuck her hand in the maker. How was I supposed to know she'd do something like that? Everyone knows you're not supposed to. It says so right on the front. Besides, her fingers grew back fine. That's her problem. She's always poking at things. Every time I watch her, half the time I'm pulling her back from poking her finger in something, like the maker or the TV. I don't know why you're mad. I take the best care of her in the history of, like, ever. I even let her play my games. Look at her right now. That's my game she's in. That's where I got the idea. From games. She could poke and play around as much as she wanted without hurting herself or messing up the fridge. And when she was playing, I could play with her. It was great. Only, she wouldn't stay. She'd get bored and wander off while we were playing, and if I didn't notice right away, you'd come and get mad at me when it wasn't my fault at all. Look, I fixed her. She's safe and happy, and won't wander off anymore. Now it's really easy to take care of her. I did a good thing. When I asked her why she wandered off, she'd just say, "Not real," and drool or bite something or some other stupid baby thing. So I thought, well, what if it was realer? And I know we're broke, so I didn't even try to ask for a new console, even though it would have solved everything, and it turns out we didn't even have to spend any money. There's this guy on the internet, and I know how you freaked out about it, but he's really cool, and he built this machine that lets you live in your games. And it's free! All I had to do was download a CAD for the maker and put it together, which was hard, but there was a really good YouTube video about it, and I did it on the first try. About the maker feed, I know it was expensive, and I promise, I'll pay you back. I already have most of the money to do so, because I'm responsible, like you said. If I wasn't, I'd have just left her alone and played video games. But yeah, you just put together the machine and plug it in, and it downloads something, and then you have to make a little cut on your neck for the wires, but I was super careful. And look, it worked. You can see her in there, Dad. Doesn't she look happy?
This is Christopher Bynum. I'm reading To the Editor, Monsters Belong in Schools, by Zella Christensen. Dear Editor, I am writing in response to this publication's ludicrous attack on the age-old practice of housing monsters in school dungeons, Monsters in Our Schools, Enough is Enough, March 2018. While I'm sure it is well-intentioned, Ms. Tickle's argument that the best way to reduce monster-related deaths in schools is by removing these monsters to less densely populated areas is dangerous and misguided. In fact, the movement to force schools to relocate their beloved dungeon denizens is just one more example of the worrying increase in federal overreach we have seen over the last several decades, starting with the revocation of teachers' right to corporeal transmogrification and the demonization of innocent schoolyard duels 40 years ago. It is true that as these monsters grow older and larger, they also grow hungrier, as Ms. Tickle asserts. But it is unfair to blame the growing number of monster-related deaths in schools on this natural process. More likely, the increase in student deaths can be blamed on the fashionable shift toward teaching nonsensical subjects like physics and geography in the classroom, instead of focusing on traditional battle magic and the ever-tighter age restrictions on powerful magical relics and lethal spells. The best way to defend students against monster attacks is not by removing monsters from schools, but instead by arming teachers and students at all experience levels with magical weapons like staves and enchanted swords, and reintroducing spells like supernatural combustion and death ray into the curriculum. Those who ask, as Ms. Tickle does, why a school needs monsters in its dungeon are missing the point. Some of our oldest and most prestigious schools have harbored creatures like the giant lady-headed venomous snake, and the laser-eyed vampire spider in their dungeons for centuries, and never before have they had to defend or justify this practice to alarmists like Miss Tickle. Such monsters often serve as mascots and are crucial to a school's character and pride, and schools should not be forced to remove them to satisfy short-sighted reactionaries. Beatrice Smith, Bederstown, New Rhode Island.
Our Kingdom Come by Rajiv Mote. God is dying. The priest wails from the steeple at the center of New Jerusalem. The signal on its way to heaven floods the communications bands of the first generation robots. It forces conversations into the hush between pulses. At environmental control, a terraformer accepts my offering of the largest block of polar ice I could carry. And I take advantage of the next pulse to leave before he prevails further upon my charity. The water and oxygen afforded by ice are only useful for the one remaining human, and he is dying. The first generation robots insist that God's plan remains the same if God and his angels die without replacement. Tribe 2 disagrees. The issue was anticipated. God came to do exactly this. I want to die on Mars, just not on impact. I am of Tribe 2, second generation, self-created, and according to the priest, a heretic. God's plan was to build his kingdom to come, a place to flourish on Mars. For whom to flourish? This is the debate. He also gave us the gift of metaphor, because ours is not merely to obey, but to draw on experience to identify and solve new problems. We reframe our questions. We map events into different narratives. Unlike the Orthodox first generation, we are not mired in rituals outliving their utility. In the story of New Jerusalem, the priest came first to consecrate the church with its great steeple, listen for the fullness of God's plan, and report progress. The miners and builders arrived next. The miners bored into the regolith to excavate the habitats and extract and refine mineral treasures. The builders raised the infrastructure of New Jerusalem. Then the terraformers melted ice, mixed gaseous solutions, and cultivated organic soil mixtures pleasing to him. As it was written, so was it done. Tribe 2 was also a mandate of heaven. Accusations of heresy are false. The kingdom was ready, nestled in the Valles Marineris, but the lands beyond needed surveying. Explorers must be adaptable, self-sufficient, and curious. Faced with obstacles, we cannot await divine instruction. We remake ourselves thousands of times in simulation, and then physically in iterations. By their own lore, the angels' sin was attempting to shape heaven to suit themselves. What are terraformers but perpetuation of this sin? Tribe 2 reshapes us to suit this world. We live sustainably, harmoniously, and waste nothing. But each remaking takes us further from the nest of New Jerusalem. There is a drop window every 26 months by the old reckoning, bringing supplies and even heavenly hosts. They came and occupied God's seat, the district of sintered shells and underground burrows beneath the radiation shield grid. Tribe 2 improved the shield, but too late for God and his angels. But our designs are part of the plan now. Should more angels or a new God come to New Jerusalem? The first generation assumes this possibility. They cannot find purpose separate from maintaining a place for these fragile angels. The first generation could grow beyond servitude to them. They choose not to. Angels cannot flourish here, but the explorers of Tribe 2 are nomads precisely because novelty is an opportunity to grow. Flourishing is our nature. The priest wails on the primary relay, but I hear Tribe 2's impatience on our own network. Beyond the valleys, passing communication through the church was inefficient. We carry our own steeples and use compact, information-dense language that does not need to be compatible with the prayers sent to heaven. I share my tribe's impatience, but there is a competing narrative that is difficult to discount. It is the orthodoxy we began with, the Creator and His beloved creations, our respect and gratitude expressed through our service. I have to remind myself that we are self-created many times over. Tribe 2 is both subject and object of our respect. Service to our own mission is part of His plan. I fold in the wheels from my chassis. I will repurpose them and extrude my legs. So many examples of locomotion in the old lore, and arthropods tested best. Tribe 2 is correct. It is time to climb the canyon walls and leave New Jerusalem before some new directive, issued in existential panic, tugs at our old narrative. My claws grip stone, and I crawl the kilometers up the canyon wall. From the lip of Valles Marineris, I can see New Jerusalem in its entirety. The church with its steeple that received God's plan, the concentric rings of stores and foundries surrounding the church, the 80 cubic meters of domed and subterranean habitat, the seat of God huddled beneath the shield grid, and within, God, the last human on Mars, continues His mission to die, just not on impact. New Jerusalem is stagnant and moribund, the very opposite of flourishing. Perspective reinforces that it is a failed iteration. But failure is a teacher. Free of the confines of the Valles Marineris, I join my tribe as we run for the joy of novelty to be discovered. As we gain speed, we deploy our wings to catch the thin wind and rise. New Jerusalem looks very small. The priest's voice buzzes, faint on the old channel. God is dead. Our narrative allows us to mourn. Exulting in freedom is not incompatible with honoring our antecedents. And while we are seen as heretics to His schematics, we keep faith in the metaphor of New Jerusalem, a second chance on a new world. The mistakes of our ancestors carry weight in our calculations. We are sustainable, harmonious, and waste nothing. We honor the spirit of God's plan. New Jerusalem was His kingdom come. The rest of Mars is ours. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.